We have with us this morning Oregon High School students. Would they please stand? I want to welcome you all. You may be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class, sponsored by the State Bar and this court. They've been invited to come here to listen to an oral argument. They've had briefs of the oral argument, and after this argument is completed, they will meet with a justice of this court to discuss the procedures, not the substantive issues that are involved in this case. The marshal has a summary of the case we are about to hear, and if anyone would like a copy of that summary, if you'd raise your right or left hand. And get a copy. You'll be able to listen and understand the argument better if you are familiar with the facts and the legal issues. Let me, and everyone is welcome to meet with the students and the justice after this case. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He is the new justice sitting today on his third oral argument with the court. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack, who is not there, yes. She generally sits there. She is not participating in this case. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Annette Seeger. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for the morning, Reuben Baez Godoy versus E.I. DuPont de Nemours and Company, and all the other people involved in this case. We're dividing our hour in the following way. 15 minutes for Mr. Earle, arguing in favor of Godoy. 10 minutes for Fidelma Fitzpatrick, arguing for Mr. Godoy. 20 minutes for Ms. Pure, arguing on behalf of DuPont, Sherwin, Williams, and Armstrong Containers. 10 minutes. Richard Mark, arguing on behalf of American Cyanide, and 5 minutes for Mr. Earl and rebuttal. Is that the agreed-upon time arrangements? Mr. Earl?
Yes, the exception to the court, how we divide our
argument. Fine. Are you going to divide the 5 minutes or just shift as to which attorney does it? Which one? Got it. Okay, thank you. We'll start with Attorney Peter Earle. Counsel?
The issue before the court today is whether it is a cognizable claim under Wisconsin law to allege that residential paint pigments designed with white lead carbonate as the prominent ingredient are defectively designed. Reuben Baez Godoy alleges that these pigment manufacturers designed a residential paint pigment by choosing to use white lead carbonate, which they manufactured through carefully designed processes, as reflected in paragraphs 12, 13, 14, 17, 18, 19, and 38 of the first amended complaint. However, despite the specific allegations contained in that amended complaint, Mr. Baez Godoy's design defect claims were dismissed on the pleadings. But allegations in the complaint must be given a liberal construction in favor of stating a cause of action. And the court is not to be concerned with whether the plaintiff can actually prove the allegations. That task is left to the trier of fact. In this case, the controlling allegations in the complaint are that white lead carbonate manufactured by the respondents was defective and unreasonably dangerous because it was designed for the specific purpose of being a residential paint pigment. That, Your Honors, is a factual allegation. It is not a mere conclusory legal assertion. It is a factual allegation. And none of these respondents were white lead carbonate manufacturers whose primary business function was to make white lead carbonate for a multitude of purposes. In other words, they were not raw material suppliers. They were, in fact, vertically integrated enterprises that manufactured paint and most of the component parts of the paint, including many different residential paint pigments. White lead carbonate was one. The complaint, therefore, also alleges in paragraph 18 that all relevant times there existed safer alternatives to the use of white lead carbonate as the prominent ingredient in pigments designed for residential use.
Mr. Earle, let me ask you a question, if I might. White lead carbonate pigment, is that used in products other than paint? From what you said, it sounded like it is.
Your Honor, my answer to that question would be that certain types of white lead carbonate can be used for other products. One of the handicaps we have in this case is since the case was dismissed on the pleadings, we're bound by the four corners of the complaint. Okay. Had we had summary judgment record that, for example, had been developed in the Thomas case, where there is, and the court construing that record in the light most favorable to the plaintiff in the Thomas case, explored aspects of what Your Honor just addressed. And what we have at this point before us are those references which indicate that white lead carbonate does, as a chemical, has other uses. It can be used, for example, in the manufacture of plastics. But we don't know at this point, and we haven't been able to develop from the record in this case, the differences and the design differences between that aspect of it and the aspect of white lead carbonate for purposes of the residential paint pigment. Okay?
So do we have to assume that the product you're talking about, which is this pigment, could be under this complaint interpreted to mean a product that is used only in paint? And that's another way, I think, of phrasing a question.
Your Honor, construing the allegations in the light most favorable to the complainant and in favor of the cause of action, I think the court needs to construe the type of product to be white lead carbonate specifically designed for use as a residential paint pigment. Okay? And I would point out to the court that the cases that deal with design defect focus on the consumer expectations regarding the type of product. The use of the word type of product is prominently in the Green case. It's not the specific product, it's the type of product. What are the consumer expectations about this type of product? What are the consumer expectations about residential paint pigments? Okay? Not specifically white lead carbonate. If we were to confine the inquiry of whether or not a design defect has been pled to the very specific product, and then we contort the law and we create barriers to the ability for a record to reflect or a court to approach the question of what constitutes the reasonable expectations of a consumer. Because within the type of product, there are different specific products. So here the product is, and we assert the product is residential paint pigments. And 40 years of binding Wisconsin precedent require that this issue be resolved by a straightforward application of the consumer contemplation test. In Green, this court stated.
Let me just double back for a minute.
Sure.
I understand your argument. The lead pigment here, white lead carbonate pigment, manufactured by the defendants. You claim that's manufactured by the defendants in this case. Is that right?
That's correct.
And you claim that white lead carbonate pigment is a component of paint used in residences.
That is correct.
And that your plaintiff was damaged by, what do you call it, inhalation or exposure to this paint, which contains the white lead carbonate pigment.
That's correct.
And now Sherwin-Williams is a name I know for paint. They also manufacture the pigment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and so they're being sued in that capacity.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
They're being sued in the capacity of having manufactured the component, not the paint itself. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And Stankowski's are what? What are they doing? They're a defendant.
The Stankowski's were the landlords.
Okay, premises. They're the landlords, and they're not really in this review here.
That's correct.
Is that right?
They are no longer in the case.
Pardon?
They are no longer in the case.
They've at settled. All?
Yes, they've settled in this case.
Okay, but this case, if we would approve the Court of Appeals, it's going to go back on notice, and that affects the component manufacturers. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's
the
correct.
Acuity Insurance Company insures one of these people. Okay. Or
yeah.
More.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. And
in this case, I'll phrase it this way. Why isn't this case totally bound and covered by the Thomas case?
I think in large part it is, especially when you combine the Thomas case with the Green case.
Well, it's covered as to maybe the liability of several defendants when you can't prove which defendant is particularly liable. I mean, the Thomas case might be read to say you've got all of you are it. But isn't this case very different than Thomas? Because Thomas, the defendant, was the paint companies that used the component, right?
Yes and no, Your
Honor. Okay, what's the yes and what's the no?
The defendants in Thomas were in large part the same defendants as here. DuPont, Sherwin-Williams, we've added to this case Armstrong Containers, who we allege to be the successors to the McGregor company that manufactured lead paint as well. And we've added American Cyanamid was in the Thomas case. And Your Honor, we have the same dynamic with regards to vertically integrated enterprises as to these manufacturers. They manufacture the component parts, they manufacture the finished product. So they
manufacture all of them are vertically.
Except for American Cyanamid, Your Honor. American Cyanamid acquired, we allege, an interest in the McGregor company, which was a paint manufacturer, but only the component aspect of the white lead carbon, and that was only for a very short period of time in the early 70s. So what you have here are these vertically integrated enterprises like Sherwin-Williams or DuPont manufacturing a defective component part, the white lead carbonate, designing it for their incorporation, and then that same component part manufacturer integrating it into the finished product, thereby rendering the finished product defective. So these component part manufacturers made a defective component part. They participated directly in the integration of that component part and manufactured by making the finished product with it, and then injuring my client by putting that product into the stream of commerce in a way that violates the consumer contemplation test.
Mr. Earl, doesn't it make a huge difference here what the product is? Now you started out saying the product is the residential paint pigment. The other side would say, that's not correct at all. That's not consistent even with your pleadings, that the product is white lead carbonate pigment. Don't we get two different answers depending on which we decide is the product at issue?
I would argue, Justice Crooks, that you get the same answer to both, either way you go. Okay? We think that the truth credited properly properly in the complaint is that the product are residential paint pigments and wet-lead carbonate. And so we are asserting to the court that that sure cuts out of it. We stop right there. We don't get to this question of inherent characteristics. We stop. Right? But if you disagree with us and you construe the complaint in a way we would argue the court ought not construe the complaint, and you do limit the product to white lead carbonate pigments, then we would argue to Your Honor that the inherent characteristics defense proffered by the defendants is completely inconsistent and would do grievous violence to the consumer contemplation test. And it's
why is that?
In the consumer contemplation test, we have basically two questions. Whether the product was defective, whether it's unreasonably dangerous. And we would argue that this thing they call the inherent characteristics defense is really a cut-and-paste job of existing, well-established, open and obvious danger doctrine cases. And we would further argue and they only reach half of the proposition. They say, well, the defect comes from some. There's no alternative way to make it. You can't make wet lead carbonate without lead. That's what they would say. And therefore, it's an inherent characteristic, and there's no alternative. So, but we would argue that that doesn't take this next step as to whether the consumer, the reasonable consumer, contemplated the risk of harm. It's one thing to know that wet lead carbonate is an ingredient, and if you say it's an inherent characteristic, consumers on notice that it contains lead, you're notifying the consumer as to the ingredient. That's not the same thing to notify the consumer and put the consumer on notice that there is in fact an attendant risk of harm that results from that ingredient, that being the extreme neurotoxicity of lead. The precedent of this court in the Peace case as well as in the Antoine A case establishes clearly that consumers did not contemplate the risk of harm in white lead carbonate. I believe that's the proper interpretation of those cases. In Antoine A, for example, the court found that a reasonable landlord, as of the late 80s and early 90s, should have constructive knowledge about the hazards of lead paint. But there you're dealing with a landlord who's in the business and subject to laws governing rental properties. Okay? But if a landlord by the late 80s and early 90s, before that period, was not on notice. And certainly the consumer was. And I think the public domain knowledge that's out there that this court can take judicial notice of is that parents still today don't understand clearly. Consumers don't understand the risks and harms associated and attendant to childhood lead poisoning. And then there's one other factor, Your Honor, because this is where I think it's critical in terms of the public policies of this court and the doctrine of stare decisis. The consumer contemplation test is so firmly entrenched in our case law in this state. For this court to depart and adopt this inherent characteristics proposition is one thing if it's done in the context of modifying the common law and moving in that direction. But what you have here is a situation where the political processes, the state legislature of Wisconsin, specifically rejected this inherent characteristics defense.
Well, they just didn't adopt something, isn't that right? Mm-hmm. They just didn't adopt.
They didn't adopt. It was proposed as SB 58 in 2006. So what you have is the political legislative arm of government looking at it and saying, should we do this? They wrestled with it, and they chose not to. Okay? So for this court, on the foundation of 40 years of clear established precedent, to take a step that the legislature declined to take, I think would be completely inappropriate.
Mr. Earl, the red light's on.
I didn't know.
Thank you. Ms. Fitzpatrick, you're scheduled to be introduced by Attorney Earl. I assume you are not a member of the Bar of the State of Wisconsin.
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Mr. Earl.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm a state lawyer.
Thank you, counsel. That motion will be granted. You're admitted for purposes of argument in this case. Council. Okay. And welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It's always as lovely as it is today.
It is lovely. I've had the pleasure of spending much time here, so I appreciate the court granting that motion. The portion of the argument that I'm here to address today is the issue of the substantial change doctrine and how that substantial change doctrine does or doesn't impact this particular case. There were three arguments that we have set forth in the briefing that we have set before the court. The first I'll just mention in passing that we've made the argument that this issue is not properly before this court because the trial court did not have an opportunity to hear or pass on this argument. The second is that this issue is simply not ripe for a decision at this time on a motion to dismiss, that this is a fact-intensive inquiry and would be more properly decided either after a jury verdict or after a motion for summary judgment. That is typically, looking at all of the substantial change cases in Wisconsin, that is typically how this court has reviewed any allegations or any claims of substantial change. That is a defense to a strict product liability claim, and it requires the development of facts specific. Because this is on a motion to dismiss, the relevant allegations in the complaint dealing with the substantial change doctrine are paragraphs 37 and 38 of the complaint.
Which complaint are we looking at? The second amended?
Oh, I'm sorry, the first amended complaint, Your Honor.
Okay.
And paragraph 37, Mr. Baez-Godoy alleges the white lead carbonate pigment that caused his lead poisoning, quote, was in substantially the same condition as it was before leaving the control of the industry defendants. And in paragraph 38, Mr. Baez-Godoy alleges that, quote, at the time that the white lead carbonate left the possession and control of the industry defendants, it was a defective and unreasonably dangerous product because, when used in the manner in which it was intended to be used, or for the purpose that it was reasonably foreseeable it may have been used, it caused substantial and severe injuries to the plaintiff. These allegations...
Patrick, let me, if I might, interrupt you for a minute. Does it make any difference to the pleadings here and to your argument whether this court sticks with restatement of torts 2 or whether or not we do something similar to what the Court of Appeals did and take a good look at restatement 3 as well?
Your Honor, I don't think for the purposes of how the substantial change doctrine comes out on this issue of a motion to dismiss versus a motion for summary judgment. And I say that for this reason. Judge Abramson asked earlier about the Thomas decision. And this court, in issuing the Thomas decision, had the occasion to visit this issue raised by these defendants of, is the defect caused by the white lead carbonate? Or is it caused by what the paint manufacturers had done? That was a factual allegation that was raised in that issue, in that case as well. And this court, in that case, had a substantial factual record before it. And in paragraph 159 of the Thomas decision, the court found that the white lead carbonate is inherently hazardous, that's the term that was used, at the time it was manufactured by the defendants, and not when it was incorporated into paint. And in paragraph 159 of the Thomas decision, this court said, in comparing the Thomas case to the DES cases, quote, first, as doctors are the ones who prescribed the dosage of DES, so too were the paint manufacturers that mixed the amount of white lead carbonate to the paint. However, the paint did not alter the toxicity of the white lead carbonate any more than the pharmacist did by filling a prescription. To the contrary, at best, the paint manufacturers actually diluted the white lead carbonate's toxicity.
Mr. Patrick, one of the concerns I have with getting too deeply into the Thomas case is that when I went back and looked at the majority opinion, which I joined, it's not at all clear whether or not the design defect approach was even touched upon in that case. Now, this matter is before this court, as you know, on the basis that the court granted a motion to dismiss on the claim of a design defect. So how does what you're telling us about Thomas help us to resolve the design defect claim that is before this court?
As it relates to the substantial change doctrine, it helps in this way. Under Wisconsin law, it has to be a substantial and material change. Any old change doesn't render a component part manufacturer immune from strict product liability. It has to specifically be one that is substantial and material. And the way that this court has looked at that particular issue is whether there's a substantial and material change in the design, function, or character of the product. And that's the Glassy versus Continental Insurance Company case. It is clear this court in City of Franklin and the Shaver case and in other cases has said a component part manufacturer can be liable under strict product liability. It can be liable for design defect, it can be liable for failure to warn. That is an established precedent in this state. It is only when that component is substantially changed that that liability of the component part manufacturer is cut off. And one of a very good discussion coming out of the Eastern District of Wisconsin in 1993 is the Kanakin versus Inland Truck Parts case. And in that case, Chief Judge Reynolds dealt specifically with this issue. What is a substantial change? What makes it substantial and material? And what he said is that it has to have been a change in the way that substantially increased or change the nature of the dangerousness of the component part. So in other words, you need to look at what was the dangerousness of the component part before it was underwent whatever change it was, and what was the dangerousness after. And if that integration or change increased the dangerousness or altered in some way the dangerousness, then that is a substantial and material change. And if he, at 809 of that decision, Chief Judge Reynolds talked about a distinction that exists between components that directly contribute to the dangerousness of the product as a whole and components that only become dangerous because they are incorporated into a final product. And the question becomes, which category does lead fall into? Was it dangerous before it was incorporated into paint? Or does it only become dangerous because it was incorporated into paint or after, because of that incorporation process? And I think this is where, even though Thomas was not a design defect case, it was a strict liability case. And I think that where the Thomas decision is important in this is that if, in this case, we had been permitted to develop the factual record, which we were not because we're on a motion to dismiss, what the facts in this case would have shown is the same as the facts in the Thomas case when construed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff showed. And that is that lead pigment was inherently hazardous at the moment, quote, the inherent dangerousness of the white lead carbonate pigment existed the moment the pigment manufacturers created it. In other words, the component is hazardous in and of itself, and that its incorporation into paint didn't increase that toxicity or increase that hazard as would be required to have a substantial and material change under Wisconsin law. And instead, what this court concluded when it had the benefit of the whole factual record was that the actual toxicity or dangerousness actually declines when you put it into paint. That clearly is not anything that rises to the level of the substantial and material change that is required under Wisconsin strict liability law. The danger of the defendant's argument here is it becomes one in which a component part manufacturer is basically immunized from liability because the simple incorporation of a component into a final product will absolve of liability because that will be a substantial change. That's a much, much, much lower bar and a lower standard, and it goes against all of the public policy reasons that this court has articulated for imposing strict product liability on a component part manufacturer. Now, there's the analogy here is one, I think, that comes up more to a cake mix, a Betty Crocker cake mix. And Betty Crocker makes its cake mix and puts it on the market, and it tells the consumer, add water and add eggs and cook it. The defendant's argument here is akin to Betty Crocker coming before this court and saying, there was a substantial change in our product because the consumer took my cake mix and added water and added eggs. So therefore, that's a substantial change. And even though my cake mix, as it was sold to a consumer, was toxic and caused harm, I'm off the hook because the consumer used it as it was supposed to be used.
I have something that's nagging at me, and maybe just a basic misunderstanding of the cases. Thomas, you sued the same people, except American Cyanide. And I didn't go back to look and see if you sued more people there than you're suing here. And your argument was that this paint in the house caused damage, and therefore you're entitled to a trial. Now you're suing the same people, except American Cyanide, and you're saying that they manufactured the component part. They manufactured the paint that used the component part, right? And the same people. But now you're not suing them for the paint. You're suing them for the component part. And that's where their liability comes in. Why wasn't this all part of the first case? Why can you divide up your claims in this manner of two different kinds of lawsuits against the same people, continually changing your claim? You won the first time, didn't you? Doesn't that settle it all out?
The Thomas case was a white lead carbonate case. We sued the defendants in the Thomas case as pigment manufacturers and not paint manufacturers.
They're the ones that mixed the pigment into the paint, sold the paint, right?
No, we sued the manufacturers of the pigment, the same people for the same reason. So here we sued the pigment manufacturers. We sued, those are the same people in the same capacity that we sued in Thomas. So Thomas actually dealt with this conflict at this paragraph 159 and a couple of paragraphs before this between pigment manufacturers and paint manufacturers, because the defendants came before this court and said this should be more appropriately, liability should be imposed on paint manufacturers and not pigment manufacturers. And this court rejected that and said, no, the liability is appropriate on the pigment manufacturers, the white lead carbonate pigment manufacturers, because they're the ones who created the product that was inherently hazardous in the first place.
Isn't that the issue here? What am I missing? What am I missing? Something is nagging at me. It seems to be the same case against the same people with just a change in the theory. Now, I did not go back and reread the underlying documents in time.
So,
you shouldn't be fighting me. You should say, yeah, Thomas is totally on point. We won that. What the devil are we doing here now? And if I were on the other side, I would say, no, Thomas is different. You don't have to overrule Thomas. You know, Thomas is the law. We didn't like it. We thought it was a bad decision. But then it's the law. And you, court, can rest comfortably. We're not asking you to get rid of Thomas. We're saying this is a different case than Thomas. I'm trying to figure out, should you just be calling Thomas, 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 and forget all the other subtle arguments you're making? Or should you be saying Thomas is, you know, good for us, but not on all fours here? And I haven't figured that all out.
I think, Your Honor, to the extent that clearly I haven't been clear, I do think that Thomas controls here, and I think that the factual determinations of this court in Thomas do control the outcome of this. This court clearly adopted...
Why didn't you bring a second? Oh, you brought a second suit because you have a different plaintiff.
We have a different plaintiff.
Okay. I understand that.
And one of the differences, Your Honor, may have been that in the Thomas case, the design defect claim was dismissed by the trial court, and that was not part of the appeal when it came up to this court.
I understand that.
So what came up was the strict product liability failure to warn.
You do. Oh, and you still have that case pending in this case, strict liability.
In this case, we have a strict product liability failure to warn plus the design defect.
It's the notice issue that was covered by Thomas, and that controls. Is that your point?
What my point is, Your Honor, is that Thomas, with the benefit of the full record, has already made a factual determination on the substantial change doctrine that inclusion in paint does not constitute a substantial change, and that that is the controlling precedent that answers that question at this time.
And you're going to argue Thomas controls the notice issue. Still outstanding. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Let's see, Ms. Fuhr. Is it Fuhr?
Your Honor.
Introduced by Mr. Benson, Paul Benson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice and Justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, my name is Paul Benson from the Milwaukee office of Michael Besson Friedrich. I have the privilege of representing DuPont in these proceedings, and I share that privilege with Ms. Joy Fuhr of the Richmond, Virginia office of McGuire Woods. She was admitted pro hoc vice in the courts below, and I now move her admission before this court to present argument.
Mr. Benson, your motion is granted. Ms. Fuhr, welcome to Wisconsin. Again, I guess.
Yes. Madam Chief Justice and members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, I hope to discuss 3 points this morning. First, that the doors of justice remain open to Mr. Godoy, and the Thomas decision is not in any way impacted by the dismissal of his design defect claims here. Second, that because the presence of lead cannot be the basis for a design defect claim in Wisconsin, that cannot be the basis for a design defect claim in Wisconsin, that claim should be dismissed. And third, that this case is not and cannot be about paint or any decisions relating to paint. And I would like to just go over some of the factual assertions that we disagree with that were made in the opening presentation. First, and I think part of this was clarified, the defendants in this case are sued as white lead carbonate pigment manufacturers. There is no allegation in the complaint that they participated in any way in the finished product. There is no allegation in the complaint that they manufactured paint. In fact, the words residential paint pigment appear nowhere in the complaint.
So the comment of Mr. Earle that they're suing an integrated company, vertically integrated company, is not in the complaint.
No, it is not. The allegation is you made white lead carbonate pigment and you knew it could be used for paint, for residential paint, and you didn't warn. This claim is just like Thomas in that was a failure to warn claim. This is a failure to warn claim, and those claims survive. This plaintiff has the exact same access to justice that Mr. Thomas had, and the design defect claims being dismissed would not only is not necessary under Thomas, but it would represent a broad, wide-sweeping expansion of 40 years of product liability law that is unparalleled. And for those reasons, what has been said earlier is we disagree. So I'd like to go into...
But if I may, I thought there was reference made to a paragraph 38 in, I think it's the first amended complaint. I'm reading from this is volume one of the supplemental.
Yes, I have that paragraph.
I thought the allegation was made that, or the representation was made, that the allegations in paragraph 38 say that the white lead carbonate was intended to be used for in paint. I mean, I thought it was directly contrary to what you just
set.
Foreseeability is not an aspect of product, of strict liability law. You look at the product. In this case, the product is white lead carbonate pigment, and the alleged defect is the presence of lead. White lead carbonate pigment is one ingredient. It is lead upon which acid has been applied. It is oxidized lead. And the first prong of the consumer contemplation test in Wisconsin is that you look at is the product in the condition that you expected it to be. And in this case, it is undisputed, and the facts are undisputed, that the white lead carbonate pigment contained lead. It is also undisputed that you cannot make white lead carbonate pigment without lead. So the essential facts in this claim are undisputed, and that is what makes it ripe for a motion to dismiss decision. The essential facts will never change on this design defect issue. You look at the product, and was it in the condition that was expected? And in this case, the answer is yes, and it is undisputed it was yes. It contained lead. You don't get to the second prong of unreasonable dangerousness if, in fact, it meets the expectations. And that is the danger and the policy danger of applying a design defect claim to a product that most perfectly meets the expectation, the inherent characteristic of the product. And we have cited in our briefs examples of the fermentation of alcohol creating beer. We have cited in our briefs that you can't make a knife that is not sharp. The other types of products that have and Dipple was the first paraphrasing of comment H in the restatement second, that you, when a characteristic is inherent to the product, it cannot be the basis for a defect, and that strict liability does not mean absolute liability. It means liability on certain parameters, and the courts have always recognized that when the defect is inherent to the characteristic, the duty of the manufacturer is to warn of that. So if you look at the complaint is you made a product, it had to be lead, but we think you should have made zinc. That is not a design defect claim. That is a you should have made a different product claim.
Also, why is the product that we should look at not residential paint pigment rather than white lead carbonate pigment?
The plaintiff in this case is proceeding under the Collins risk contribution theory of recovery. And under that theory, in which he acknowledges he can't say residential paint pigments because the doctrine has only been expanded to white lead carbonate pigment. The other reason is that...
In Thomas.
In Thomas. It was expanded to white lead carbonate pigment. He does not know whose pigment is on the wall. He does not know whose paint is on the wall. He, on the face of his complaint, says zinc would have been better. Well, on its face, then, zinc and white lead carbonate pigment don't carry the same risks of harm, so you can't expand residential paint pigments and have that be a risk contribution. It doesn't meet the factors. He's saying you should have made zinc instead of white lead carbonate pigment, and that you can't do because he also says that no matter how you made it, it was identically defective. And I think the language he used was no matter what you did, no matter how you made it, all of it was functionally interchangeable, physically indistinguishable, and identically defective. So all these decisions that were made about paint, should you put it in to residential paint, should you not put it in, should you use zinc, is not a factor in looking at the product and the design defect, which is none of that matters. It all was the same when it comes down to the defect. It had lead.
Sometimes I am dismayed that cases with lots of files and briefs and come down to something that seems a bit arbitrary. Is this case disposed of in totally different ways if the product is residential paint, if we decide it's residential paint rather than white lead carbonate? Is that determination dispositive?
He needs to identify the product if he's going to sue paint. He has to know who it is. And people sue paint companies all the time. They identify the paint, they say you should have made it a different way, and they go to the jury on that. You cannot sue a white lead carbonate pigment maker and then say, hey, we're really complaining about the paint, and those paint makers should have put different ingredients in their paint.
One of my former colleagues would use the phrase, it's outcome determinative, so let me use that phrase, is whether the product residential paint pigment versus white lead carbonate pigment outcome determinative in this case?
It has to be white lead carbonate pigment in this case, or he can't be here because he can't identify the product. And then, because in order to proceed on white lead carbonate pigment, he has to know it's lead, and it has to be all these other things.
Oftentimes, as I was trying to articulate, it is the scope. You know, we can narrow a question and refine it so that in different levels of generality, there would be different outcomes. Is that what we're doing here? Or another way of asking the question is, why, again, please tell me, we have to choose the product being white lead carbonate rather than pigment rather than residential paint pigment? Explain that again. I know you've done that, but
there are a couple of reasons. First, he's proceeding under the Collins risk contribution theory of recovery, and that has only been expanded to white lead carbonate pigment. Second, the defect that is alleged in this complaint is that the white lead carbonate pigment or the residential paint containing white lead carbonate pigment contained lead. The allegation is that, I mean, everybody knew white lead carbonate pigment contained lead. This, it's in the name. It's in the product. In fact, Wisconsin statute says white lead carbonate pigment has to contain lead. It's Wisconsin statute 100.186 enacted in 1909. So if the product meets the expectation of the consumer and it has to contain lead, and he can only proceed against these manufacturers as white lead carbonate pigment makers.
But that argument, at least the last part of your argument, to me is circuitous. It assumes that the product is the white lead carbonate. There is a certain kind of the factor in this case. It doesn't take a scientist to tell you that white lead carbonate you expect to contain lead, right? But I'm not sure everyone would expect residential paint pigment to contain lead. And so you're telling me that we would be expanding the Collins, the DES, from white lead carbonate to residential pigment. That's one reason that we should keep it at white lead carbonate. We don't want to expand it. What's the next reason? Because that seems to start to be circuitous.
Well, DES was a failure to warn claim. Yeah. It was not a you shouldn't have made it. So why can't it be residential paint pigments? Because he doesn't, one, it's not in his complaint. He hasn't stated a claim for residential paint pigments. His complaint is you made white lead carbonate pigment, and you knew you could have made a different residential paint pigment for use in paints. So he hasn't said, he hasn't alleged any other paint pigment that we could have made other than if zinc had been included in paint, that would have been better.
Are they equivalent, residential paint pigment and white lead carbonate pigment? Is the only place that white lead carbonate pigment is used is in residential paint pigment?
No, in fact, the plaintiff has conceded in oral argument at the trial court level that it had other uses such as plastics. And again,
same kind of pigment, same exact two batches of white lead carbonate pigment, exactly the same. I said one to Sherwin-Williams for paint, and I send the other to Plastics Company for plastics. Is that what you're telling me?
It's a raw material.
And I know. And are you saying the exact same raw material?
My understanding is that white lead carbonate pigment was the same irrespective of those two uses. You got a bag, and you could put it in one use, or you could put it in another use. Every court that has decided this issue...
My question make any difference to the result of this case?
No. The product is white lead carbonate. The defect is lead. You can't make it without it. Those are undisputed facts. And he's got to find... And so that's incurable. You can't fix that.
Those are manufacturing a radioactive material. It's inherent in the product is radioactive. I can just send it around to everybody, and they can incorporate it into their product, and they can put it in a product for diet pills.
Well,
that would reduce weight fast.
To zero. You you have to warn. The duty of the
man. Okay, we'll get the warning, because this is not a warning case. That warning issue is still going to be tried. So can I manufacture radioactive material that I know is going to be used in a diet pill, send it out, and not have any liability? And the only liability is the manufacturer of the diet pill. Is that right?
The liability that you have is to warn those inherent
okay.
defects.
Okay, then your answer to my question is I have no liability except for warning.
Design defect liability.
What other kind of liability can I have?
You can have a failure. You can have a defect based on a failure to warn.
I agree with that.
And
the moment.
And assuming that the radioactive material was properly made and it came as expected, radioactive, it would not be a manufacturing defect. Just like this white lead appeared as everyone expected when you purchased it, you thought you were getting lead and you got exactly what you thought. It was not manufactured incorrectly. And they are claiming it should have had a warning. And if it's an inherent defect that should have been warned about, warnings, don't use it around children. Don't eat it. Don't put it in paints. Don't put it in residential paints. That's your duty when you're making a product where the inherent characteristic is the danger. And the courts recognized for 40 years, very few products have no possibility of danger.
Well, then your answer to Justice Bradley should be, I don't care what you call it. You want to call it white lead carbonate pigment? You want to call it residual paint pigment? You want to call it, it makes it easier to spread? It's better than butter pigment. You know, whatever you want to call it, there's no liability because what you're selling is lead.
If all residential paint pigments contain lead, but they don't.
I know, but in this case, whether the complaint called it white lead carbonate pigment or called it residential paint pigment, we're still only talking about lead carbonate pigment.
And
it doesn't matter what you call it.
No, you could call it Joy's pigment.
That's right.
But it's the content of the ingredient and the basis of the defect.
So it doesn't matter what you call it.
It's the content of the product that matters and the alleged defect.
And the content here is a lead pigment sold as such for residential paint, and you say the only obligation is duty to warn, and that is a different case.
That's right. You have a duty to warn that is preserved under Thomas. It's preserved, and it is consistent with 40 years of product liability law. The Dipple case was the first one to recognize that when it said the inherent useful products may have inherent problems. A fish hook can be sharp. The drinks can rot your teeth. Sugary drinks can rot your teeth. Those are types of products that have useful applications, but they also may have dangers. And the only complaint here in this case is that a single application, residential paint pigment, was dangerous. So the duty to warn was don't use in residential paint pigments. Don't use for residential paints. Don't use it for a home where there might be children. That's the basis of the complaint, and that fully survives.
Could I analogize to something to clean the toilet or
Drano?
Drano, okay. What I don't know what's in Drano, but it's lye or something poisonous.
Caustic. You don't, and the duty is to warn. People who buy Drano know that the inherent characteristic of that product is the caustic nature. Little kids get hurt. They get left alone by a pool, like in the Vincer case. In the Drano case, they drink the Drano. You don't say, sorry, don't make Drano, or you can't make Drano without it being caustic. You put a warning. Keep it away from the kids. The flames in the lighter. Kids burn up with they get hurt with the flames. Everybody knows that the lighter's got to have a flame. You warn it. Keep away from children. You don't say, don't make a flame. You don't make certain products. The ramifications of allowing the inherent defect to be the basis, the inherent design to be the basis for a design defect would be that you would have to remove products from the market, useful products that can be used with a warning. And the plaintiff cites the Green case for the proposition that you just should take it off the market. Well, the Green case doesn't stand for that. It says, if you cannot warn, then you may consider taking it off the market. They didn't say don't make rubber gloves. They said, if you cannot make a warning that is adequate, perhaps you need to consider it. They don't say based on the design.
Well, does it make any difference here if we apply Restatement 2 or Restatement 3? As you know, the Court of Appeals took a good look at Restatement 3 and yet said, we haven't adopted that in Wisconsin, but does it make a difference?
You do not need to adopt the restatement second here to find that the presence of lead in white lead carbonate pigment cannot be the basis for a design defect.
You're talking about, we don't have to adopt restatement 3.
You don't. You just need comment H. You don't have to adopt restatement H. You can do restatement comment H of restatement second, where it says a characteristic of the product itself may not be the basis for a design defect. You do not need to adopt the restatement third. You don't need an alternative design requirement, none of that. There is no way to make white lead carbonate pigment without lead. Those facts are undisputed. The essential facts here are ripe for a motion to dismiss.
How would one of the defendants here give warning or notice to Ruben Baez Godoy?
The warning would go to the purchaser of the product. Be it the paint maker, most likely the paint maker. Now, the Godoys moved into this apartment in 1997, more than 30 years after you could make paint containing lead. So if it was the professional painter who painted the house or the paint maker, the warning goes on the bag of the white lead carbonate pigment. It says, warning not to be used in and around children, not to be used for residential paints. That's what they could argue. And they can proceed under those theories, which is what the claim states. And then the paint maker has a duty to say, you know, pass those warnings along. Goes on the bag to the person purchasing the lead.
It seems to me they violated that duty once they put the paint on a residential piece of property.
The paint manufacturer manufactures the paint. And if that is the case, then they have that failure to warn claim. All those remedies survive here. Time is up. If I may take a minute to wrap.
Conclude in a couple of sentences, please, counsel.
Yes. For the reasons that I have stated, the court should affirm the decision below because presence of lead may not be the basis for a design defect claim for white lead carbonate pigment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mark, you will be introduced by Attorney Beth Hannon.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Beth Ermatinger Hannon of Gass Weber Mullins. I'm Wisconsin counsel for American Cyanamid. It's my pleasure today to introduce to you Mr. Richard Mark, a partner with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe in New York. He has been admitted pro hoc vice for argument today.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mark, welcome to you to Wisconsin.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. May it please the court, my name is Richard Mark, Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, and I represent American Cyanamid on this appeal. I'm joined in court today by my colleague, Elise Ekman, as well. I am arguing a distinctive issue in the case, an additional ground on which the order appealed may be affirmed, and that is that the element of strict liability law in Wisconsin, which requires the plaintiff to plead and prove that the product at issue reached the plaintiff without substantial change from when it left the control of the defendant, that the complaint on its face pleads facts which require judgment to be entered for the defendants, dismissing the strict liability claim.
This goes to all the defendants, not just your client. Is that right?
That is correct, because all of the defendants are treated in the complaint the same way as being sued, and that the liability against them is asserted to be based on the manufacture of white lead carbonate.
The component part.
That is right. And the significance of this doctrine to strict liability law is this. First, let me say that I join in the arguments of my colleague, Ms. Feuer, and we emphasize once again that this is an interlocutory appeal from an order that dismissed the strict liability design defect claim. The failure to warn claim remains pending, and the court is open on that claim just as it was in the Thomas case. The issue here relates to whether you can plead strict liability design defect and the substantial change element. Indeed, if you go back, as the court plainly has done, and review the decision in the Thomas case, the only issue that was before the court at that time was the extension of risk contribution, where the issue was the plaintiff's inability to identify the manufacturer of the product. The rest, in the summary judgment context, had to be treated as provable. So going through that opinion, there are paragraphs which lay out what the elements of the claims that a plaintiff would still have to prove in order to win. And in discussing strict liability, the element of substantial change remains one of the elements that it is plaintiff's burden to plead and prove in such a case. It was not decided in the Thomas case. Thomas left it open and provided an opportunity to do that. On this complaint, however, the plaintiff can't pursue that. The strict liability claim in Wisconsin, as is common, based on 402A of the Restatement Second, includes as one of the elements that the product reached the consumer without substantial change from the point when it was manufactured.
So what's the change here?
The change, which is apparent on the face of the complaint, is that the defendants are alleged to have made white lead carbonate. The product that the plaintiff is alleged to have ingested is paint. And that is apparent, as I say, throughout the complaint. Indeed, it is apparent in the way that the issue statement in the plaintiff's brief came to this court, which describes the product using a term nowhere found in the complaint. The plaintiff cannot articulate the claim here without modifying and adding a descriptive term, limiting the particular use at stake here to residential paint pigment.
If we accept your argument, then no manufacturer of a component part can ever be held liable under a design defect because its component, by definition, it's not in the same vein as the final product, right? So a wheel on a car manufactured as such is not the same as once it's put into the car, maybe.
It depends, Your Honor. I don't think that a affirmance on this basis would lead to the blanket result that Your Honor has posited. What is being argued here on substantial change is perfectly consistent with the Franklin Ford Badger truck sales case, which was that predates Glassy by a good bit, but it is consistent with that. The issue is, in Glassy, a test was stated by this court, change in design, function, character. That's the test that applies. Is the change, under that rubric, something that is material to the alleged injury? We say that on the face of the complaint, it is apparent that it is, because the allegations of the complaint, for example, paragraph 22, paragraph 28, paragraph 30, paragraph 31, talk in terms of what the plaintiff was exposed to as being paint in the residence, paint chips, paint flakes, paint dust. The 22 indeed differentiates, I say, between the product defendants are alleged to have made, described in paragraph 11 as white lead carbonate, compare that to paragraph 22, which refers to the defects and hazards of white lead when used as a pigment in paint. You heard plaintiff's counsel say, heard counsel for DuPont reiterate, white lead carbonate has many different uses, and it's white lead carbonate either way. it makes a particular difference, as apparent to the court, to my client, because even though the result is the same for all of the defendants in this case, we feel this particularly acutely. Cyanamid did not make paint. So,
did you make residential paint pigment?
No, we made white lead carbonate.
So to you, it does make a difference how you denominate the product, right, in your analysis?
I think that the difference may appear semantical, but what Your Honor's questions highlight is that the case really is about failure to warn. It describes, if you characterize it in terms of a use, as opposed to something about the product. And strict liability looks to the product, not descriptions, warnings, instructions that accompany it. Strict liability looks to what is the product. And the categorical description of this stuff is white lead carbonate. That's the proper description of it. That's what the complaint alleges the defendants made. But to try and shift it into residential paint pigment really says, you know, you should have told people that that wasn't an appropriate use, not that, and indicates that the character, the design, the function of it has changed. Just as in, for example, the Hasse case. Silica is silica is silica. It was argued in that case that Badger Mining knew, and it was foreseeable, that putting it into molds in the foundry and blasting it off the manhole covers was going to turn it into something that was unsuitable for that use. That did not make a difference. This court specifically rejected that as an element of strict liability. And I emphasize again that I'm talking only about the strict liability claim here. So that is why, in a policy sense, remember, the great revolution, which we have become so used to in the course of 40 years, of 402A, was the elimination of the privity requirement and the notion that if you're going to have mass marketed products, you didn't have to prove that kind of connection between the consumer and the maker anymore. But the trade-off between eliminating privity was to say that if you're going to go on a strict liability basis and sue for something that's wrong with the product, looking only at the product and not at the manufacturer's conduct, then what you're suing over had better be the product that left the manufacturer's control. In this case, that is white lead carbonate. You see in the amicus submissions the consequences or the thought processes that a ruling in this case evoke in the business community. A company in the position of Cyanamid supplying this as a generic, as an ingredient, can't be put in the position of being the police officer for possible downstream uses one way or the other for a product.
Well, I'm still bothered by this. So suppose, and food is always something special, so but I can only think of it. Suppose you manufacture, dry, and process oregano, put it in, and sell massive bundles of it to a pizza place, right? And it becomes a component of a pizza, right? And there's a... In processing this, you add a little lead or whatever you want to add that is deleterious to human health, and people get sick from the pizza. Is the component person liable because it's not in an unchanged form? Or, I'm sorry, it isn't a changed form. I've mixed it into the tomato sauce.
The oregano in that circumstance really isn't oregano, and I think that would invoke other problems.
I mean, it's a raw product as oregano, but is there such a raw product as lead is not lead, the same lead as in other products when it's in white lead carbonate pigment.
May I try one?
Mm-hmm.
The West Bend Company makes coffee urns. And we've all been to parties where they have the coffee urns and they get blazingly hot on the outside. They're thin metal, stainless steel or aluminum. The question is, when you go back, not to West Bend, but to the aluminum foundry and say, because aluminum transmits heat, and it's going to transmit heat no matter what, the aluminum foundry can be sued because someone at a PTA party was burned when they touched the West Bend coffee pot. And this is going all the way back to the aluminum foundry. The aluminum foundry would say, I made aluminum. It has many uses. I'm not policing whether West Bend's use of that in the coffee pot, and it substantially changed from when it left my control. It could be used for any number of things. That's how the substantial change doctrine works in this case.
So if there's not, and you, what's the substantial change here? You manufacture this white lead carbonate pigment, and it is not changed other than it's mixed into the paint. It might be mixed at one part, it might be mixed at one-tenth of a part, per whatever else is done. What's the change?
The change...
Still there? Exactly the same?
The change is actually, and referring back to Justice Bradley's question, the change is that it has been incorporated into residential paint, and it is that use and that delivery that's complained of. Were the same thing incorporated into anti-fouling marine paint put on a submarine, plaintiff would not have a claim.
But your argument, taken to its logical conclusion, is no component then becomes liable because it's always changed by definition. It is a component of something else.
Not necessarily.
And that's different than maybe the aluminum, which is still aluminum.
I still don't think that's necessarily so for the reasons, for example, in Badger Truck. That tire, and in that case, you have the chassis maker, the tire maker, the distributor, all on the hook on strict liability with a question of contribution between them. But the tire was not going to be anything other than a car tire. And it couldn't be used for anything else.
They've got to see it, smell it, taste it, exactly the same as it came from your company.
For strict liability,
that's
the case.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Earl?
Your Honor, may I reserve 2.5 minutes of my 5 minutes for Fidelma Fitzpatrick to address?
By the time we're finished, you'll have used the 2.5 minutes. Go ahead, Mr. Earl.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Listening to the arguments of counsel, I'm reminded a bit of the story in Alice in Wonderland of the Cheshire Cat, who is sentenced to death by beheading by the Queen and then says, I have this ability to make my body disappear, so you can't behead me. So we've sued the lead pigment manufacturers. I said lead pigment manufacturers, manufacturers of the component part, who were vertically integrated enterprises who manufactured the paint, integrated the pigment into the paint, designed that white lead carbonate pigment for that purpose, and we allege that in the complaint, despite the protestations of counsel, and then they smile like the Cheshire Cat and say, you can't hold us liable in strict liability because we are only white lead carbonate manufacturers. Well, our complaint alleges they are white lead carbonate pigment manufacturers, that they designed that pigment for use in residential paint. And when the complaint is read liberally, with an eye toward stating the cause of action, we must be credited for that. And this whole issue here kind of demonstrates the problem of dealing with a case like this on the pleadings. Because, for example, pigments have the function and are designed to have the function of opacity and protection of the surface. That comes from the Thomas case. Your honors ask yourselves the question, what is the function and purpose of paint? It's to provide opacity and to protect the surface, which is painted. Pigment is one of two constituent component parts of the paint. It's applied for that purpose, and it's designed for that purpose. A summary judgment record may, for example, illustrate that there was fierce competition amongst the white lead pigment manufacturers over the degree of whiteness of their respective white-lead carbonates, that there were different manufacturing processes, and there were blends of the different manufacturing processes for the purposes of enhancing opacity, whiteness, and other characteristics that were suitable for the purpose of incorporation as a white-lead as a residential paint pigment. So I wanted to stress that at the beginning, and there's a certain tautology to all of this. That when you reduce it, you say, well, you can only challenge the defect of that very specific product, and if it's the inherent characteristic, then there's no design. Comment H does not stand for that proposition. Comment H, if the Court of Appeals below cited Comment H for its definition of a design defect, it said a product design is defective when it has harmful ingredients not characteristic of the product to itself, either as to presence or quantity, but also from foreign objects contained in the product and from the way the product is packaged or prepared. Now, does Comment H, read fairly, remove from the scope of design defect all products in which the design characteristic is inherent to the project, to the product? I don't think that's a fair reading of Comment H. I think what Comment H in 402A does is it says it's the basis for the misuse of product doctrine. It says that a product is not defective when it's safe for normal use. What is normal use? The intended use is the use for which it is designed. White lead carbonate pigment was designed by these manufacturers for use in residential paint. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just have three brief points to make on the substantial change doctrine. The first deals with the argument that the design function and character of white lead pigment is somehow different than the design function and character of leaded paints. Mr. Earle dealt with that on a factual level. But the reality is it's the wrong analysis. The analysis is not whether the design function and character of white lead pigment is different than the design function and character of leaded paints, but instead whether the design function and character of the white lead carbonate itself has changed. And it hasn't. And that is the heart of the substantial change doctrine. The substantial change doctrine says the actual properties of the component part must have changed substantially and materially in a way that is related to the injury in order to absolve of liability. That has not happened in this case, and with a fuller record, factual record, that those facts would come out and would be perfectly clear. Second, Mr. Marks talked about suing white lead carbonate manufacturers, but alleging that the injury comes from ingestion of paint. That is not a fair reading of the complaint. If you look at the complaints, all of the paragraphs that were cited by Mr. Marks, for example, paragraph 27, the plaintiff sustained lead poisoning by ingesting white lead carbonate. That is throughout the complaint. The injury in this case came from the ingestion of white lead carbonate, not the ingestion of paint. It is the carbonate that causes the injury itself. And then the third thing I'd like to address is in reference to the Hasse case and this issue of foreseeability. What the defendants have done is they have confused the issues of foreseeability with the issues of intended use and intended design. The Hasse case was one in which silica, as it was produced and as it was sold, was not dangerous. It was only when the silica was fractured and broken to such an extent that it could be ingested, that it was physically changed, the physical properties of the silica were changed, that it became hazardous, that it became dangerous because it could be ingested. Hasse case turned on the question of was it foreseeable that the silica could have been fractured and physically changed, and said that is not an analysis. The correct analysis here is the expected use, which is all over strict product liability law. I see I have a red light. So.
Counsel, may I ask a question?
Yeah. Justice Cross.
I'm trying to understand the distinction that you would see, if you see a distinction, for a manufacturer, say, of caustic, who sells that caustic to Drano, knowing that it's going to be used in Drano. And then there's the potential that children can swallow the Drano. How is that different analytically from what you're arguing here on the white lead carbonate?
I think it's important. There's a few distinctions. First of all, the assumption that was made by the defendants in this case is that the consumer expectation test rests on knowledge of an ingredient. And that would be the case of the Drano. You know it contains a caustic ingredient. Because you know it contains the ingredient, that is all that needs to be known. The consumer contemplation...
How do you know that?
Pardon me?
How does the consumer know that?
I'm assuming that it's on a label. Just like in the white lead carbonate context, the defendants are of the mindset that because it contains the word lead, the consumers at the time were on notice of the fact that it contained lead, so therefore it met the consumer contemplation. The consumers had an expectation that it contained lead. But the reality is, if you look at the law from this court, it's not whether the consumer expected that it contained a particular ingredient, but whether the consumer could expect the degree of harm and the degree of risk to be posed by that particular product. And so in the context of the Drano, the manufacturing, and it again would be a very fact-intensive inquiry, which is what is making this such a difficult proposition and a motion to dismiss. Did the man, and there's a thousand questions that could be asked, did the manufacturer of the caustic ingredient, is it Drano? Is it the same company that put it in? Is it a different company? Was it manufactured for the intended purpose of going into Drano with the knowledge that it went in? Is there a substantial change in what happens? And these are all very fact-intensive inquiries, which is why this court has always reserved on these particular types of issue until the factual record has been developed. And I think that that's what the problem, because what's happening here is we're mixing concepts of bulk supplier and component part, and those are getting confused here as to whether this is a bulk supplier or whether this is a component part manufacturer. It's getting confused between an open and obvious danger of something like a knife and whether the use of the term lead constitutes an open and obvious danger or it doesn't constitute an open and obvious danger. And the Drano analogy compounds that because there are so many facts that based on those specific facts, it may or may not be a strict product liability against the manufacturer of the caustic agent, depending on the particular facts of that case.
Thank you. I want to thank all the counsel involved, Mr. Carl, Ms. Fitzpatrick, Ms. Fuhr, and Mr. Mark for their very interesting argument in yet another product liability case and the second lead paint case. That concludes our hearing in 06-AP-2670, Godoy versus DuPont, Demours, and others. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third oral argument for the day. We're in recess. I'm sorry. I should have told you all that Justice Prosser is the justice in charge today at noon, and if the students and anyone else who wishes to wait will wait, Justice Prosser will be out immediately, if not sooner.